This is the Ritz and Cures podcast with Lindy Burns, lawyer Bill O'Shea, and psychiatrist Dr. Steve Allen.
Yeah, this is Ritz and Cures for the final time this year. And
Lindy, do you think anyone out there wants us to come back next year? I don't think so.
If I've learned anything in the 25 years that I've been doing radio, is you never open that up.
Never open it up.
Well, never open that up.
Well, I suggest you get on Steve's Facebook page and tell him what you think.
That's right. And if you want to see Steve's Facebook page, it has a picture of him dressed as Robin
on the
front of it. Tonight we're going to have a chat about musicians and, in fact, the need for them to protect the copyright in their music. And I reckon how difficult it is to do, particularly in the years of the internets. So we'll have a chat with Marcus Walcom about that. We'll also look at some startling results on how little Australian doctors know about the law on end-of-life decision-making and why that law needs to be simplified. And we are also going to talk about some stuff that came up courtesy of the Treasurer today in Scott Morrison with his mid-year economic fiscal outlook announcements. And indeed, the health industry and healthcare was significantly targeted, but in ways in which it's going to affect whom the most, Stephen?
Well, I don't know if it was significantly targeted. $600 million over 4 years. Is that a lot of money?
In terms of what's been...
Not to a pathologist.
It's made the big story. It's made the big splash. Although there was cuts to arts funding and other areas as well, which didn't get so much talked about. But certainly in health.
And they did flag some other health cuts without being exactly very specific about what they were. But they said there'd be bigger cuts over the next 4 years. But the one that got a lot of coverage in the media today, at least, was the cuts for the bulk billing incentive for pathology and diagnostic imaging.
What does that mean?
So, look, in essence, every time you go to a doctor or anything, there's a fee set by the government called the schedule fee. So say you go along and the fee's $100. In theory, the doctor gets $100 for that. You pay $15, 15%, and the government pays 85%. The doctor can choose to bulk bill, in which case he just gets the 85%, you don't pay a cent, and it saves you some administrative fees, that sort of stuff. And so they try and encourage doctors to bulk bill. A lot don't, and a lot charge above the schedule fee. They might charge the AMA recommended fee. So for a service that's worth about $100, the AMA will normally recommend that you charge about $130. So that's the way it works. And in 2009, Kevin Rudd brought in this bulk billing incentive scheme for pathology and radiology, basically saying we'll give you pathologists and radiologists an extra 15% in return for bulk billing everyone and not charging anyone anything out of pocket. Bulk billing rates went up a lot to about 90% across pathology. The government today has said, look, we think there's a lot of competition in the field. And they've essentially said, we think that they're an easy target, they're a bit overpaid, and we're going to cut back that incentive from 15% to, I think it was 10%, with some exemptions, kids under 16 for some of the tests and people who are got a healthcare card for some other tests, not all. So with some protections, and of course, people are a little bit upset by it because they feel that it could be a disincentive to ordering tests for people who can't afford it.
And the tests that could save people's lives. So what sort of tests are we talking about? Tests for what?
Most pathology tests are blood tests, but there's a whole range. They can be various other tests as well, like, you know, looking under a microscope at a skin lesion, like Bill's had a half a dozen skin lesions removed, and some pathologists earn a bit of money looking at them.
Would you mind giving my personal health information out of the program, if that's okay?
Because he likes to bring it up himself.
What about the concept of precedent, where you have brought it up about 1,000 times? You've entered it into evidence. And
it's called filleting. You just go and get yourself filleted every now and then.
And the other one is some of the diagnostic imaging, in particular MRI scans, I think they hit.
Not before time.
Well, I'm with Bill on this. Look, quite frankly, the AMA and everyone came out today saying it's outrageous, but you might remember a few weeks ago it was part of my manifesto of how to cut medical costs. I think we do too many tests. I think there does need to be some disincentive. I think the system, Medicare, was set up with the idea that there was some sort of payment from the person, because if you have something that's just totally uncapped and you can order as much as you like or do as much as you want, then of course there's an incentive for doctors to do too much.
So that's why they do it. It's rather than the patient, because we talked about this with Nick last week about the way in which doctors are feeling the pressure from patients coming in and saying they want antibiotics, yeah. and you know, what's the chicken and what's the egg here,
and blood tests. They want blood tests.
Yes. So is it because patients are demanding it, or is it because doctors are just thinking, well, here's an easy little scrape for me?
No. It's the patients are anxious often, and they do want it. The doctors are nervous. They don't want to miss things, and so they order a lot of tests, and it's easy to order a lot of tests, and the system incentivises a lot of tests.
GPs don't get a cut for that, do they?
Well, but they get... Well,
it depends if they're running a clinic.
If they're running a big clinic, they might have a pathology company that's paying them handsome rent and other incentives. There's a whole lot of processes in place to try and stop this because it's rorting, so there's a lot of processes in place. But I'm not convinced that the checks and balances are excellent. I think we do have too many tests. There's far too many normal tests. The pathology companies make a small fortune. They're all listed on the ASX. Their profits are just unbelievable. The whole industry is heavily...
Will this change it?
Well, it's a tiny cut.
Blip on the radar.
It's a blip on the radar. I'm surprised everyone's getting so excited about it. I think they're only getting excited because it's the only detailed release. Once we get a lot more detail, I'm sure we'll get excited about it.
So you get excited to stop the next cut. It's really about warning the government.
Well, the AMA have come out, and also the opposition have come out saying, oh, this is co-payment by stealth. I think that's a misrepresentation because it's clearly just taking away an incentive that was only introduced in 2009 and taking back Medicare to the same as it works for every other test and every other doctor in the country. So it's not a co-payment.
Well, when they're going off for arthroscopes, when are we going to say that they're not rebatable?
Well, there's so much that needs to be fixed about the health system. There's so much. I won't pick on arthroscopes, even though they're an easy target because there's far too many of them done with far too few indications. But that's just, again, the tip of the iceberg. There's far too much.
Norman Swan did it, didn't you? Look at that Four Corners 3 months ago.
Well, at the end of the day, it comes down to this. Do you believe healthcare is too expensive in this country? Now, some people say it's not and it's good value for money, but the costs are blowing out. We've got an ageing population. It seems to me completely obvious that we need to do something to address the costs, and we need to protect the poor and the sick, and these sort of measures are a good beginning in my opinion.
What do you mean by sick?
The people who are chronically ill. We don't want them to collect a whole lot of costs because they might have to have tests every week.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be caps on everything. There needs to be protections for the people who have chronic illness and the people who are poor. Because we don't want those people excluded from the health system. We do want to catch all the over-servicing and the people who are wealthy. You know, free tests for wealthy
people.
Speaking
of wealthy, would you say in your profession, diagnostic people, pathologists and imaging people, are the wealthiest?
Or is it just the plastic surgeons? Look, there are certain groups that are clearly far wealthier than others. And I do think of them slightly as the newspaper moguls of medicine.
Yeah.
They do tend to have clifftop beach houses and that.
But isn't it just looking at...
Well, I don't want to pick on any group.
Isn't it just looking at what a machine prints out at the end of the day? Yeah, got to give a report. But the machine does the work, doesn't it?
Well,
how much looking down the microscope
test,
is
depending
there?
Depending on the test... Our machine does a lot of the work, but like looking down the microscope can only be done by a human largely. Mm. I think machines can do a little bit of it. So, no, it is a real combination. And the pathologists have to oversee stuff. And I'm not knocking they've done 10 to 15 years of training and they deserve their income. I'm not saying they're all
greedy. Do they personally do it, or do they employ juniors to do the looking down the microscope?
Well, these days it's a lot of big companies employing pathologists on a wage.
But it also depends what they're looking for.
I don't want to single out anyone.
It is important if you get it wrong. We all want to know whether,
exactly.
The lesion's been completely removed or there's still a bit left. I mean, you all want to know that, and it's very important. But
Chris wants to know, when do the changes begin?
1st of July.
And another that says, don't forget, too, guys, that people who have illnesses that require regular blood tests.
That's what we're talking about, chronic illnesses. Yeah. And poor, protect them too.
And there's a few texts about whether you should come back next year. One that says...
You ask, Bill.
Yes, my husband would not like Tuesday evening as much if you don't return in 2016.
Oh, that is thank you.
Nicole. Yeah. One that says, Bill, Steve, show. I even tuned in and switched from ABC 621 to listen to these guys every week. Thank you for a splendid year, says Angela.
Oh, isn't that nice?
And this, Lindy, I think I prefer Bill three sheets to the wind like he was last week with his Benny Hill persona. And Pip says, I'm a pathology collector. I get paid $20 an hour. It hasn't changed for years, but certainly my company is always boasting about what they earn. That's from Pip.
Yeah, the big companies are making the real profits.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, can I just say last week, a lot of my friends have come up to me to say, to praise me for my stand on office Christmas parties. And could I say to all the people in my office, I hope you're all having a nice time while I'm in here at the ABC. But you all really gave me a hard time last week. You said people should be personally responsible. It's a big brother. And what happened? The Age published an article just after our show last week. I could have written it myself. A responsibility.
Well, I believe that you did ghost the whole thing. That's my understanding of it all.
I had my Christmas party on Saturday night.
Did you
I
behave
didn't follow
yourself?
Any of Bill's rules.
And what happened? Oh, don't tell us.
I Ubered home at about 5:30 a.m. That's Ubered. Enough said. Yeah, well, I couldn't drive. I had to ride my bike back to get the car the next day.
That's very, well, you are responsible.
Yeah.
Believe me, if you want more Bill, and who doesn't, then you can always listen to our podcast of Ritz and Cures. You go to the usual
But you censored
podcast,
last week. You told me you censored
Yeah,
it.
I took some really rude stuff out. because we don't want them to go to air any more than once. Thank you very much. But the podcast, the majority of the podcast is there for
Just
you to enjoy.
I was nasty to a few doctors.
I did notice, Bill, that it was very hard to edit stuff that you were saying or stuff that I was saying or Bill or Steve was saying because you were just saying it over the top of us.
Yeah, I think he was four sheets to the wind, actually.
We'll come back in a moment with more Ritz and Cures. We're going to talk now about some startling results on how little Australian doctors know about the law on end-of-life decision-making and also why the law needs to be simplified. So if we haven't gotten stuck into doctors enough in the first 10 minutes of this particular Ritz and Cures, it's time that we went further into it. This comes from the Medical Journal of Australia from last year, Bill, yeah?
That's, which I read, you know, going to bed most evenings.
Yeah. Steve's face is priceless.
This is Ben White from Queensland. I mean, he's Queensland, but you know, we'd listen to what he's got to say, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Queenslander?
Yeah.
I suppose you would.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's published
this. Queenslanders. I've worked up there for a year.
Yeah, you've worked everywhere. You're probably on sabbatical.
Everyone tries to get rid of me.
On a holiday trip.
Just
anyway,
interrupting.
What this is about is that Ben and his friends sent out 7 questions to 3,000 doctors asking them true or false on various issues around end-of-life care to see how much they knew about the law, because Ben's a lawyer. And this is not an occasion to get stuck into doctors. It's an occasion to get stuck into the parlous state of the law, because it's totally confusing for everybody, and confusing law is bad law. And that's why in Victoria we're about to hopefully get rid of the Medical Treatment Act and have some simple laws where you can make a medical power of attorney and it's clear, and you can make an advanced care plan and it's clear and it will be followed, etc., by legislation. So he asked these doctors 7 questions, 3,000 of them across Australia. And you might think, well, how many would the doctor get out of 7? What do you reckon the average score was out of 7 for all the doctors across Australia?
I'm thinking 4.
I'm thinking 5 or 6 because I think doctors know the law pretty well.
You should know the questions first, but 3.26 was the average. 3.26 out of 7, right.
Does that reflect the doctor's knowledge or the legal questions?
Well, that's across Australia. Then if you go by states, the worst state was Queensland. The best state was New South Wales, but their average was 3.65.
What sort of questions
out of
are
7.
They?
Yeah, now should I?
So they get about half right. They just pass 50%.
Yeah, but they're not. You don't get a Nobel Prize if you get these right, let me tell you. I mean,
The questions?
Well, I'll read one out. And you've got to know a bit of what the terminology is. Person responsible means.
Read the questions out as they're asked.
But the word person responsible is going to be in the question.
And that will be defined.
It's a bit hard to unfair to ask listeners. Okay. So, but all you doctors out there listening, and allied health and nurses, I expect you to participate. Get a pen out and go and you've got to write true or false. And if you do, the ABC will give you a prize.
They won't.
We'll send them the podcast.
And all the doctors will turn off when I said that we're overpaid.
That's right.
You'll get a free podcast.
Right. The questions.
Here's one question. In a non-urgent situation, if the family or friends of an adult who lacks capacity can't be located and there's no refusal of treatment certificate, you, the doctor, can give artificial nutrition and hydration to the patient without obtaining consent or notifying any person or organisation if you believe the treatment's in the patient's best interests. So it's a non-urgent situation, you can't find anyone to consent, and you're going to give artificial hydration, medical treatment basically, and you can't find the person, but you think it's in their best interests, and you, the doctor, you can go ahead. True or false?
Well, I do this for a living. I work in a general hospital. It's false. You can't. You would go to the guardianship or board or something. This is what I do for a living, though, so it's not fair.
It's not fair to put you on
the
spot.
I work in a general hospital dealing with all
these
issues.
That's correct.
This is what I do.
It's false. You've got to get consent. You can't just proceed.
Because the key was non-urgent.
Non-urgent.
If it was urgent, you can. If it's non-urgent, you've got to go to the trial.
That's the difference.
Yeah. See, you coming to the show has really improved your legal knowledge. You know? Here's another one. Any so-called person responsible, which is usually the nearest relative, has legal authority to refuse life-sustaining treatment for an adult who doesn't have capacity. In other words, the nearest relative
can make the decision on behalf of the patient.
To refuse life-saving treatment for an adult who lacks capacity. True or false?
That is trickier, but I'm going with false. I think they can. I don't think you can refuse.
False is correct.
Yeah.
There's one person who can refuse, and that's a person holding a medical power of attorney.
Right.
But not just the relative who happens to be the. In the queue, so that's correct.
Because they might be refusing for all sorts of, you know, complex reasons. You know, it might be to get the money from the will. There's all sorts of other factors going on,
okay.
So you have to, again, consider the broader issue.
Now, what about this one? For decisions about whether to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment, a substitute decision-maker, like a relative, doesn't have legal authority to overrule a valid refusal of treatment certificate completed by the patient when the patient had capacity. So the patient's got capacity. They say, I want to refuse antibiotics if I go into a coma. They go into a coma, and then the person who makes the decision, the relative, can that relative override the refusal of treatment certificate that the patient gave before they fell into the coma? Or does the refusal of treatment certificate, is it there for keeps?
I hope it was.
It is there for keeps. They have the right, though, to go to, say, a guardianship board and try and fight it. Like, they can take anything to court. So you can go try and fight
a valid refusal of treatment certificate.
But if the court finds
it
valid, wouldn't it?
If it's valid, right? It's valid. It will override everything.
Yes.
Lindy said, "What's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole point of doing it is when you fall unconscious, you want them to do what you've refused.
Exactly. That's why you put it a few other ways.
Part of the reason, though,
well, you know, we've got relatives here. They're putting pressure on us. The patient's unconscious. He or she'll never know." So let's just do what the relatives want.
They do that a little bit with organ donation.
Yeah, they sure do. We won't go
but
there.
Can I just say, though, part of the problem here is, again, it's the legalistic nature of the questions. It's a bit like if I say to you, what's the product of the integer with a value of 3 and the whole number with a value of 2? And you look confused and I'll say, well, all I said was what's 3 times 2? It's 6. You know, they ask them in such a difficult way that I don't know if it's that they'd... Like if you put those into clinical cases where you said, okay, imagine you've got a 65-year-old man who's written a document that's legally binding saying, I don't want antibiotics if I get pneumonia, and the family come in and say, we want you to give antibiotics. 99 out of 100 doctors would say, you wouldn't give the antibiotics. You've got a legally binding document. But when you ask it in those... tricky manner, I think bamboozles.
Doctors can be held up for medical trespass if they ignore a refusal of treatment. It's very serious.
What sort of doctors are we talking about?
ICU doctors,
right. So not
emergency
GPs.
Department doctors.
Yeah. So these are the ones who were receiving the questions.
Palliative care doctors.
Yeah. So people who actually work in that particular field of medicine.
No, the people who got them were right across the board.
I would imagine that there would be people who would work as a GP who would not know that.
Yeah, that's true.
But they would not be the ones making the decision.
No, they wouldn't be that. And they did badly. The ones who never make the decisions, who admitted that, did badly. But who do you think the worst performers were in the survey of all medical specialties? Who were the worst?
Surgeons.
Surgeons weren't asked because they're always in the theatre.
No point.
Respiratory doctors. Respiratory doctors. Well, you think they have a lot to do with end of life.
But I would suspect, in all honesty, I'd suspect that's just a statistical anomaly. Someone has to end up worse.
Average 2.68 out of 7. That's pretty bad.
Maybe it's just because they're good at keeping people alive and they never face that.
Second worst, medical oncology. Second worst.
That's surprising.
Yeah,
you'd think oncologists would be dealing with this sort of stuff.
So people who are working with cancer patients all
the
time.
You'll guess the best.
Geriatricians. Old age doctors.
Are the best, Okay, let's have one more for
one
your
more,
time.
One more, quickly,
The law requires you to follow a valid refusal of treatment certificate that refuses life-sustaining treatment completed by an adult when he or she had capacity, even if providing that treatment is clinically indicated.
What does that clinically indicate mean?
By their condition. You know, they've got infection. What's indicated is antibiotics to treat the infection. The patients refused it when they were competent, and the law requires you to follow that refusal of treatment certificate, even if, for example, antibiotics should be given.
Well, I mean, that one seems completely obvious to me. Of course,
the same
you have
question
to follow
we
had it.
Before.
Yeah. It's actually the same question.
How are they? No.
Yeah, but also that's one's too easy because you wouldn't offer someone something that wasn't clinically indicated, so it wouldn't be relevant to consider anyone refusing
it.
That's
one more quick one.
No. There's more to talk about, and then you're going to run out of time.
All I'm saying is that they're not mind-boggling questions, but the law is confusing, and we've got to fix the law.
That's actually the point.
And not blame the doctor.
And I agree with your conclusion that I think we need to teach more law in medicine.
That's the point.
It's like a few weeks scattered around a five-year course.
It's the unconscious patients who miss out because they can't argue their case, and the overbearing relatives always win. That's what happens.
There's a text here. It says, come on, Steve, I don't think there's a trick here. The cleaner has just got 3 out of 3. Surely this is called common sense.
I'm with you. So it is common sense.
It is totally
what was my score
sense.
In the end? Did I score?
Yeah, you scored.
Did well. Perfect
score. Did really well.
13 of
my arms are in the air in case listeners can't see.
13 of the 3,000 got full 7 out of 7. Only 13. All of them were at the Alfred. No, not true.
Tiffany has sent us a text from Colac. She's saying that she's a pathologist. So going back to the conversation we just had.
I'm in trouble.
Most of us actually work for salary for large corporations who make money for shareholders.
Yep.
We largely earn less than other private practitioners and are also appalled at the money that these big corporations make. We are not the ones with cliff-top houses, I can assure you.
That's the point you were making, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the current generation are all working for the companies because around about 10 to 20 years ago, the big companies bought out every pathologist in Melbourne and they're all my mates with the clifftop mansions.
Oh, is that interesting? Yeah. So it's sort of the next step.
Yeah, the next generation of salaried.
Yeah,
but I think they're still making very fine salaries, Tiffany, because a few of my mates are salaried as well. It's there anyway. And not that I'm knocking it because it's across the board. It's not just pathologists. There's lots of big wages.
And Susan says, Bill, Steve, a glass of red and a sunset. What a better way to spend a Tuesday evening. I think we should send Bill to a Christmas party at least once a month next year. Can you make that happen, Lindy? Sure. And this from Mike, my friend Mike in Chum Creek. Guys, no question about keeping my two favourite buffoons on next year. Quite apart from the fun, you guys introduced me to the one neurologist who could say what was happening in my brain. That's no small order, I assure you. How does the saying go? If you save one person, it's worth it. Thanks again for a fun and informative year of whatever it is that you guys do. That's from Mike.
That's very nice.
Good.
Yeah.
We had two neurologists on this year, though.
Yeah.
Just wondering which one.
One, I reckon.
We had Ingrid Scheffer
about epilepsy.
Sam Berkovic.
We should run a book on Ingrid Scheffer winning a Nobel Prize. I reckon, you know how they take a long time to award them?
Well, the two of them work together. In fact, we might have had Sam on late last year.
Sam and Ingrid, yeah.
So before we go to our final guest of the year, let's just do a quick look back at 2015 and the emerging trends that came up. In medicine, what was the big thing for you, Steve?
Oh, the biggest trend in medicine is really big data in general. So the massive genetic tests we can do now, the expanding range of real-time physiological tests, like you can have little monitors under your skin these days if you want to, monitoring all sorts of stuff.
Who's paying for that?
You'd pay yourself, hopefully.
Yeah.
So this huge data and how we analyse it and what we do with it, because it can lead to incredibly good early diagnosis, enormous amounts of information, but that doesn't necessarily bring us new treatments. The big hope is that we'll get personalised medicine. We'll get treatments that are specific for the exact sort of cancer you have, the exact biological defect that cancer has, et cetera, and that we can start to test for them. But we haven't quite... That's the promise.
Yeah.
But we haven't got the treatments to quite match it yet. But that's the way we're heading.
That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about data retention. That's the biggest problem in the law. Funny you should talk about
it. Biggest problem in the world. It's issue in the world. How
well,
do we
data
do
retention
flood of data
laws
everywhere?
Scary, really scary. Yeah. The fact that everybody now knows everything about you. And there are laws now that give them rights to do it. And the Law Institute and lawyers generally don't believe there are adequate protections for the normal citizen. I thought you'd talk about what Nick Card spoke about last week and superbugs and how we could be going back to the 1920s
yeah,
and
the
people
antibody.
Will die.
That's one of our biggest risks. But you know what? No one's. You know, at the end of the day, most people think the scientists are going to come up with solutions. And it may be wishful thinking, but I agree that's the biggest risk. I'll tell you my area of most promise that I've been impressed with. I think there's been a genuine change in the mood of the community with drugs and alcohol to move slightly away from policing and more towards health solutions. Solutions about supporting people, getting them off drugs, reducing addiction, rather than jailing people and all the rest of it. So that's the thing that's brought me most promise this year.
Well, even just some of the statistics that are coming out just in terms of alcohol and drug usage in the younger generation coming through, it's kind of astonishing.
I think the
way in which that's shifting, so that's downscaling. There's a real sense about, you know, of well-being and health being one of the priorities, which wasn't there certainly in my generation.
Well, I think 2015 will be the year of the woman.
16, I think if, next year.
No, this year.
Oh, this year.
If you look back on this year, I think Time magazine should put the women's you know, logo thing on the cover of Time. When you think about
logo
well,
thing.
Domestic violence,
oh, yeah, mm-hmm.
What Rosie Batty's done in Australia, just the whole issue, women coming out against Cosby in the US, women getting the vote in Saudi Arabia. Women really have made huge strides forward in 2015 that really I can't remember a year. I mean, just the campaign against domestic, well, not just the wrong word, family violence. What sort of a profile has that now got compared to a year ago when Rosie Batty was named Australian of the Year? And not just in Australia, but everywhere. And I think it's, I mean, we've got a new woman head of the ABC. I mean, it's the year of the woman, 2015. And
yeah,
I think the world's a better place.
Wage parity, percentage of CEOs.
What about the women
at
Monash Health sticking up for themselves in the theatres? Where now the AMA, the
College
of Surgeons, College of Surgeons have said we don't care on skill. We're going
to
put 50% of women in operating theatres.
Baby steps. Yeah. There's been some baby steps.
Yeah, but that's steps.
Yeah, I agree.
Steps
no,
a year ago.
Absolutely stepping.
Fancy
in the
College of Surgeons coming on board. That's amazing. They took on board the bullying stuff.
I want to see the result before I'm going to crow from the rooftops.
Better than not having it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction.
This is the Ritz and Cures podcast with Lindy Burns, lawyer Bill O'Shea, and psychiatrist Dr. Steve Allen.
Our special guest tonight on Ritz and Cures is Melbourne music and entertainment lawyer Marcus Walcombe. He's a solicitor at Media Arts Lawyers in Melbourne. He's got experience in all facets of entertainment and commercial law, and as a litigator, having practiced both in Australia and in the UK. His practice is focused primarily on the music industry. He's represented high-profile artists and managers, producers, labels, publishers, festivals, events, and startups throughout the world. He has a particular interest in working with new and emerging talent, and he's assisted in procuring and negotiating and advising on local and international deals for his clients. He also runs an independent label and a management company called We Are Golden. In many ways, if you look down the list of the firms, the client list of the firm, it's a who's who of the Australian music and entertainment industry. And for some 20 years, Media Arts Lawyers have given practical and commercial legal advice to artists and brands, etc., throughout the entertainment industry. So there's all sorts of things to ask about. Well, how does that all work, particularly in 2015 and beyond? Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Why did you choose this particular branch of the law to pursue? Were you a musician yourself?
I was, yeah, like most people working in the industry, sort of a failed musician who's decided they want to then work in the industry. So I was at university studying and had some career advice where someone suggested that perhaps if you can combine your passion with your vocation, you might have, you know, the job satisfaction might be there and if you can find that. So I, being passionate about music at the time, hunted around, jumped online and found that there was such thing as a music lawyer who specialised just in that. So knocked on some doors, was rejected many times, took me to the UK where eventually I knocked on more doors, interned, got a job, and then got a job offer after that in a specialised music law firm and eventually found my way back to Media Arts back here.
What's the biggest legal issue within the entertainment industry? Deal with the most?
Most of our stuff is transactional work, so it's creating, negotiating and drafting contracts on behalf of our clients. And obviously, IP is what everyone thinks about, and it is the basis of what we do.
IP standing for?
Copyright, yeah. And obviously, there are other, you know, intellectual property involves also trademarks and designs and patents as well. But our predominant focus is on copyright law and the contractual elements surrounding that and obviously dealing with the different copyrights on behalf of our clients.
So band agreements?
Band agreements, yep.
So is that where you get to, you know, put in a rider? I demand only blue Smarties, vodka from Russia. Is that, yeah, do you do that all that sort of business too?
We don't deal with that. That's the manager's role, which I've had at hand in sometimes. So our band agreements are generally sort of the first thing that our clients, when they do come to us at a junior level, would kind of help them out with. And that would be, you know, it's like any agreement. It just documents the rights and obligations of the parties and how the relationship works.
So in terms of band agreements, that's the relationship between each of the band members.
Yeah. And
members. I thought you meant, between like the venue and the band. And
no,
what
they're a whole
other
turn.
So have you got a band agreement? Steve, you're a drummer. You got a band agreement?
Yeah, we've got an agreement that I'll pick up the pizza on the way to the jam and someone else brings the beer. And that's the extent of it. It's not written.
Well, what about if you
doesn't
compose
need to be written.
What if one of you composes something? Who owns the copyright and the song?
Yeah, well, that's
come on, Marcus. Who owns the copyright?
Well, it depends. That's what can be determined by the band. You get instances where generally the author of the work would be the owner of that, but a band agreement can amend that. Things like, I always use the example of Coldplay. Chris Martin, who's the main singer-songwriter of them, predominantly writes all the songs and brings them to the band, and then they put their little fairy dust over the top of it. But it's not really a collaborative songwriting effort, but he agrees to split all his songwriting 25% with all the other three members. So,
right.
But then bands can have... You might have instances where a band is, the songwriter takes all the money, takes all the ownership and then registers that with APRA, which we can talk about a bit later on. But he then agrees to distribute some of the income associated with the exploitation of that copyright with the other band
after
members.
APRA pays him or her.
Yes, and right. And there'll be other sources of publishing income as well.
And what happens when they split up?
That's the biggest issue. And ideally, if you've got a band agreement in place that can deal with that, that provides avenues in which to deal with a split. Most importantly, and I think issues with band names are one thing, and one of those would be you'd want the leaving member, so to speak, to assign their rights in the band name to the remaining members.
Oh, well, you'd have that in the agreement?
Potentially, yeah. You generally would. That would be something you'd
it's
like
so
to
hard
document.
To preempt, isn't it?
But they don't.
You don't know, yeah.
Because I'd imagine that there would be some that, well, most, pretty much every band, who you either are doing it retrospectively, which is almost too late, or B, you're putting it together in the beginning and it seems so
for a band who's just getting together in a room and rehearsing, crazy. The last thing they think of is formalising a legal document.
And they've got no money to do it.
That's the other thing,
and it sort of seems the antithesis of the artistic process. You know, you're normally into to a band, you're not the sort of person, you know, you're creative, you're not the sort of person.
Is a marriage ceremony the antithesis of true love?
In my opinion, it's illegal. From my experience, or are we talking general?
It's illegal.
Come on, we've just drawn the most ridiculously long bow there. Coming back to you, Marcus. So.
Well, what can kind of, a lot of bands don't in the early stages, but what can spark an agreement is if they incorporate and they get to a point where their business is growing, that they form a company, and it might be they might have several companies, in which case they'll then draw up a shareholders agreement, which effectively would be a band agreement with additional requirements, as you know, under the corporations law, in addition to what a normal band agreement would be. But that can be the time when those issues do get documented.
So formal. If you're a young band, you know, and you're out there listening right now and you're jamming in your garage and you've played a couple of gigs at the local pub, when would you recommend a band like that comes and speaks to someone like you?
As soon as it comes to the point where it's no longer a hobby and it becomes a profession.
You're making any money at all.
Yeah, and I mean, that's even, you know, bands early on can make... There's a lot of bands who are taking it, trying to be professional. We're only earning $150, $200 a week at playing a gig. But there can be, you know, other bands who are doing it as a hobby who are earning just as much, but it's not really what they're wanting to do. But as soon as they're looking to take that next step and become a more professional outfit and maybe have a career in the music industry, it should be something they should definitely think about. And it doesn't need to be formally necessarily, you know, with a lawyer to do it. It can be something that they draw up themselves.
There are free websites, aren't there, with free information?
There are, yeah. Arts Law's got a great website.
That's a community legal centre?
Yes.
In Melbourne?
Yep. Throughout Australia, I think. Right. Sydney-focused, but yeah, they do have Melbourne representatives.
And that has tips and FAQs and all that
Sort of stuff. Yes, and they also have a volunteer legal service, which the lawyers at our firm are all part of.
That's good. So that costs nothing.
That costs nothing. It does, which is it's a good thing about it. I always find it interesting about band names, and I always think of, you know, like the Little River Band, for example, which is a classic story for me. Which was so crazy that in the end, the people who put together the early days of the Little River Band lost the rights to call themselves that. So when they do anything now, they call themselves, you know, Shorrock,
their actual names,
etc. So is that, do you recommend that people register the band name in?
Well, they did in that instance. So the Little River Band
they
did.
Gave it away.
My understanding, I don't know a hell of a lot about the actual matter, but my understanding is that it was, the trademark was registered but owned by a company, which then these former members left and parted ways. And I don't think it was a very friendly split.
No.
I think it was quite acrimonious.
Yeah.
In which case they must have then agreed to part ways with the company. Whoever's still retaining it, I think, is a former guitarist, or a guitarist.
Yeah, I think it was a guitarist.
And he's now, must be, from what I gather, the only director shareholder of that company and therefore owns the trademark in the name and then can stop other people using it.
Tell me about record producers. If you go to a record studio, can't they snare some of your copyright? Because can't record producers change the performance?
Yeah, well...
let's talk about what are the rights.
Well, there's the two separate rights you're looking at there. You've got the composition, we call it, which is the musical work, and the associated literary work. So the literary work will be the lyrics, the musical works, the chords.
So each of them has a separate copyright.
Yes, and oftentimes a literary work and a musical work are intertwined to the point where they can't be separated out. In the instance, they can be. In some instances, you look at Bernie Taupe and Elton John. Elton John writes the melody and the chords, delivers that to Bernie Taupe, who writes the lyrics on top.
Right.
So they're two separate works, a literary work and a musical work. But in most instances, a band writing a song together, it'll be the one work that shall share.
But there's also a performance copyright, isn't there?
The performance right is part of that musical work. So as part of copyright, there's a bundle of rights being the reproduction right, the public performance right, and also the right to make an adaptation.
So they can be separated. You go along and you've never recorded anything before and you go to the studio and you've got a studio producer and he says, why don't we just tweak that and make that note a bit different?
Well, a recording is another copyright as well.
So there's another sound recording.
Generally, essentially the two copyrights in a song that we hear on the radio, there's the musical work, the composition, and then the recording of that. And they're generally owned by two different people.
I want to make this simpler.
Sure.
I want to use the Beatles as an example.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I've complicated.
No. I'm just thinking... I mean, I kind of have a bit to do with the music industry and I'm still a tiny bit confused.
Yeah.
So, and you're not making it complicated. It is complicated.
Yes.
That's the way it is. So, okay, the Beatles. So you've got Lennon and McCartney who wrote music and lyrics together.
Yep.
So the composition side of things is jointly owned by
them. Jointly owned by them.
50, not 50, not 50, let 50, it be. 50, 50. I don't
no.
think it's
well,
it.
Stop, Bill. Well, you're complicating it. Stop it now. So that's how it works there.
Sure.
Then they go into a studio.
Yep.
Before we do that, so where do George and Ringo fit into that? Because
nowhere,
anywhere,
unless there was a band agreement whereby George and Ringo were to get a split of the income associated with that.
I'm walking out.
And then
nothing for the drummer.
So then they go into a studio and they record it. So there is another copyright that's around that performance.
The sound recording. So that'll be, within that sound recording, the sound recording is generally owned by whoever owns the medium on which that recording's embodied. So whoever owns the master tape. So that's generally, in the traditional sense of the Beatles, it was...
Sir George Martin, maybe?
No, as a producer. No, he didn't. So whoever paid for the recording.
Oh, okay.
Abbey Road.
What was the name of their original?
Apple.
I thought it was
their
Apple,
label,
yeah.
Ultimately. Yeah. I think they were EMI to start, or Parlophone to start
Parlophone,
with.
Parlophone, that's right.
So that Parlophone would have owned the sound recording. And what also, anyone who performs on the recordings, and this only happened after the Beatles' time, actually, it's more of a later edition, became a co-owner of those copyrights, the sound recording copyrights. But what a label will do is they'll have, under their recording deals with their artists, they'll have those artists and performers assign all their rights in the performance to the label, so the label owns that 100%.
So it's like a book publisher. It's like a book publisher asking for your copyright before they publish your book.
Yes. Yep.
So when we play a song from the Beatles on the radio, where does the ABC's money go to? Who does that?
That will go to APRA. So APRA's the performing rights body throughout Australia and New Zealand. And so they're responsible for granting licences to music users, so radio stations, TV networks.
Venues.
Yeah. Festivals, whoever's publicly performing music.
Telephone.
Shops.
Telephone
shops
in your office.
Shops,
gyms, even public PTs now are getting some of them. If they get to a point where there's enough people who they're, as part of their class, they might also have to get an APRA licence as well.
PTs? Sorry.
Personal trainers.
Sorry. Oh, personal trainers.
Come on, Steve.
No, I didn't know that either. It's all right.
I'm not up with it. I'm not hip.
So what happens
with this thing called music?
Money then. So where that money from APRA then
goes
back
to?
So
that will then go to APRA, and then APRA grants blanket licences. So anyone who is a songwriter will join APRA, mm-hmm. and they'll assign their public performance rights to APRA, who will exclusively control that. APRA also has affiliations with similar bodies all throughout the world. So then APRA's body of, repertoire, which they have, is effectively any commercially released music in the world.
Yep.
And some not released yet, but it's been written and then registered with APRA. So any song that's ever played, APRA will require a license from, say, the ABC, and then they'll then distribute that to the original copyright owners, being the songwriters, depending on the... what Way level of the license fee they get.
Yes.
Including downloading online?
Yes, because that's publicly performed.
And do they pay the same? Do they go through APRA too?
They'll go through APRA, yes. So there'll be all kinds of, how the license fees and how the algorithms are determined for the payment to the songwriters is quite difficult. And APRA processes, you were talking about data earlier, APRA processes mountains and mountains of data now to process. They do... Radio stations is a bit easier. They'll get direct logs of songs that are played. But when you're dealing with, smaller community stations and smaller TV networks or venues and stuff, it's harder to apportion the amount of
revenue
they've
Pandora
got to the actual.
And Spotify on top of all of that.
Yes,
now.
And they'll be distributing logs of the amount of streams to APRA, and they'll somehow be processing that amount.
Just out of interest, do you have any idea if Lindy plays a Beatles song now, how much money would go to whoever owns the Beatles now? Any idea? It's like a
APRA?
Cent or 5 cents or 0.05 of a cent.
And I'm,
any idea? So I know
someone
it's a tough
might
question.
Know this more than me. From what I understand, it's about on a sort of ABC and Triple J, it's about $10 per play, roughly.
Wow, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Commercial radio, you get more.
Can I bring in some tapes of
that,
our songs?
You can.
From my band, Lindy, and get $10?
Sure. I don't know if it works that way, but you can see.
I'd have to register with APRA.
It's actually interesting about that because...
Won't necessarily go that full amount to the actual, to Lennon McCartney.
But that's how much it costs.
According to all those copyrights.
Yes, yeah, effectively.
Which is, no wonder they, I get letters from management going, play less songs, Lindy. They don't. I'm just making jokes. Okay, this is the other issue now in terms of copyright. Someone goes to a gig, they record it. Mm-hmm. Before you know it, it's on YouTube. It's unbeknownst to the performer. How do musicians protect themselves from that?
YouTube's a whole another can of worms. But what YouTube's tried to do because of that is they've got a content ID system in place which tries to recognise what songs are forming part of the videos that are uploaded. And they'll then recognise that, notify the original rights holders and go and let them know that this video has been uploaded, and they can either demand that it be taken down, or they can ask that that channel that's hosting the video be monetized, and that money, the flow through of advertising revenue generated from that page, that video page, will go through to the original rights
holders. Who pays the money when it's monetized? The viewer?
No, from advertising revenue, I think. Because now if you
YouTube
go on YouTube, yes. Well, it'll go through YouTube through to the rights holder.
So if YouTube says we won't monetize it, they'll take it down.
If you ask to take it down, yeah. So there are certain artists who are staunchly against any of YouTube videos or any of the recordings online, but others might see it as promotion and might see it as...
Which brings us to moral rights. Because this is like a moral rights issue, isn't it? You've got to explain what moral rights
are another bundle of rights, yeah. So they protect effectively the integrity of a copyright owner, of an author of a right. So it's a right to be properly accredited as being an author of the actual work.
What about in a cover? Can you do a bad cover? Is that breaching moral rights?
No, because once the song's released and the first... what's called a first use mechanical license is granted. There's then, once that's been out in the public and that first use mechanical license has been granted, there's the compulsory license scheme. So anyone can make a cover subject to them paying a mechanical license to the original songwriter.
Through APRA?
Through APRA AMCOS, yes. Or maybe potentially directly to the publishers, which often happens when you're dealing with the bigger labels and the bigger publishers, they have direct licensing avenues in place.
It sounds like it all should work. Like it seems complicated, but it sounds like these groups are there and to protect the artist. How good a job do they do at protecting the artist?
As in APRA?
Yeah, APRA.
They're fantastic. I mean, they're not-for-profit and they're members are all artists and songwriters,
anyway.
So their interests are purely aligned with songwriters and composers.
They're fierce too, aren't they? There'll be people listening who run businesses who might have music playing in the waiting room who get an audit from APRA and they get threatened with, you'll pay us the back 10 years you owe us for playing this music and never
There's a lot of venues, particularly smaller, not venues necessarily, but smaller businesses who do use music and who are unaware of APRA to start with.
So APRA have offices on the ground going to venues, going
they
to
do.
Shops,
yes.
yep. getting on the
kind
tram.
Kind of like Mikey Police.
Nice, except nicer. And protecting something good. I've been up against Mikey this year. I've been in the courts this year.
Successfully.
You've hit a raw nerve. Yeah. Yeah. We won.
Yeah, well, I'll do some operations next year.
Allens versus
Stay
Mikey.
Stay out of the law courts. So it is extremely complicated. On moral rights, though, you say that once someone's published it and there's a mechanical writer there, can I go on and make a complete mess of Moon River and Henry Mancini won't object to that, even though I can't sing it at
all. That could be your argument, but then, what, one man's trash, another man's treasure? So someone could effectively that song.
So
that
wouldn't be a breach of their moral rights, me making
it
a
can be.
Of it.
There's a right to not have your work subject to derogatory treatment, but
so what about parodies?
It's quite subjective.
Because I'd be buying that just to use on a comedy channel.
Parodies are exempt under, there's a fair dealing provision under the Copyright Act, which exempts parody and satire amongst some and for news, I think, as well.
So, that's right. So you can actually do, you know,
what you can be exempt from infringement if you incorporating a copyright work as part of a parody or satire. You can without having cleared it from the original copyright.
So what about sampling then? Because that's the other one that sort of follows into that, where a band takes a part of another song and puts it in their song. They sample it, to speak.
Well, that's you need to clear the rights with both, as we're talking about the two rights before, the composition, so from the owner and controller of the musical work and the literary work, and also the sound recording. So if you're using a sample, you'll need to clear the rights with both whoever owns and controls those.
Who does that? They work in the public service all day and they play in a band at night. Who writes letters off to the owners of the copyright? They just do it, don't they? And breach.
If some of them become successful, then you can be sued.
The most famous one of the lot is a guy who goes by the name of Girl Talk from the US, I think, and he samples anything from sort of like 1 to 8 songs at a time. Everything is sampled, all produced on his computer. Unbelievably talented, brings something new to it. But he gets away with it, doesn't he? He doesn't get...
US has a fair use provision where it provides for the ability for, in those instances where it's deemed a smallish enough and not a substantial enough portion of the original work that he can slide through. Technically in Australia, he's quite... He would be
if someone took
work,
him to court.
If they did.
I think people are so pleased to be on his songs that they just let it pass.
They just let it go through. I think that there would be sometimes you want to crack down and sometimes you wouldn't. Mm. Marcus, thank you. That's been absolutely fascinating. So fascinating that I didn't get a chance to actually say at any point during that conversation who we were talking to, a reset, as we call it in the business. But it's been great to have you here. Marcus Walcombe, who's a Melbourne music and entertainment lawyer, our final guest on Roots and Cures for 2015. Still so much to talk about. Come back and see us again, will you?
That would be terrific.
And thank you, Bill. And thank you, Steve.
Have we got copyright on our podcast, Steve? We had to ask Marcus before we leave here.
I'm going to sign him up.
I don't know actually what might happen if you didn't have that.
Then just our lawyer here. He'll deal with you on the podcast.
He doesn't need to deal with me because remember, I'm on the podcast as well.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Bill O'Shea, Melbourne lawyer and Associate Professor Steve Ellen, who is with Alfred Health, our two contributors to Rits and Cures. Yeah, the podcasts are available. Just check them out, see what you think of them, and enjoy just some of the good work that the boys have put together this year.